Good morning or afternoon to you. This is Professor Nick Burnett in COMS 103. The lecture for today is Technology and Its Impact on Communication in Organizations. I want to begin by saying that my job today is to not become an MIS professor. My job is to be a communications professor and to talk to you folks a little bit about the way in which technology has dramatically altered the way we communicate in organizations. 25 years ago, email was not a tool that anybody in business used. Today, I would argue it is the dominant tool by which we communicate at work and in our personal lives. So I'm going to spend some time today talking about how technology changes organizations, how it changes communication in organizations, and then I'm going to focus the last half of this relatively brief lecture on email and some of the studies that have been done of it and why we know it needs to be paid some special attention within the workplace. Okay, I'm going to begin by talking about some trends regarding technology and how they change organizations. I think one of the things that we know for sure has changed as a result of technology is that organizations have gone from tall and thin to flat and wide. And the reason for this is that technology allows companies to supervise more employees with less supervisory help. An individual manager can keep tabs on the work of more employees than they used to simply because of the communication technologies that are available. And so reports can be emailed on a daily basis. You can get in touch with your sales reps in the field on your Nextel network. All of this helps to change the way organizations look so that instead of tall vertical organizations, we have a lot more decentralized organizational decision making, and we have the ability of companies to not have to be in one giant central location. They can spread out across the country or across the county, wherever it is they're working, and be closer to their customers rather than all need to be in the same big building so that they can communicate and have meetings and be sure that people are doing what the executives and the executive suite want to happen. So I think that technology changes organizations by making them flatter, and that, of course, is going to change the way communication happens in an organization, because when you have flatter organizations, you tend to have decision-making that is more decentralized. People closer to the bottom of the organization have input. People closer to the bottom of the organization have the ability to affect change, and that's what technology, one of the things that technology has done. We also know that technology has dramatically increased productivity in organizations. I can perhaps most dramatically point this out by asking you to consider a scene from a movie in the 1940s where somebody walks into a large room where there are literally 50 or 60 women, and they would have been women, at their typewriters typing memos, typing minutes from meetings, typing all sorts of documents. I don't think we even have this term in our lexicon anymore. It was called the typing pool, and when you wanted something typed, you simply sent it to the typing pool and it would get returned to you. The point is that what used to be done by 40 or 50 women or people in a large room can now be accomplished by a single person at a personal computer. We've had dramatic increases in productivity. People are able to do more work because technology allows them to do that. The result, of course, has been there's a decrease in employees that are able, that's the second part of productivity, right? When you have fewer people who are able to produce the same amount of goods or services, then you have increases in productivity. And certainly what technology has allowed is for companies to be smaller and to do the work that usually took many multiples of employees to do in the past. So that changes. We tend to have smaller companies doing the same amount of work. A third issue or trend in technology is a dramatic increase in information sharing. The information that used to be held very closely at the top of an organization now really needs to be spread down throughout the organization, and we have the ability to do that because we have technology that allows us to see. For instance, there is a trend, I'm not sure still how popular it is, but began with the availability of technology, called open book management. And open book management meant that individual employees within a company all had access to the general ledger. They could see where money was coming in and where money was coming out. They could see how their department was being held to certain standards and, you know, how much money they had to save or how much money they were allowed to spend. The result is this could not have been possible in the past because of the vast amount of information that has to be managed for this to work. In the old days, you'd had to have somebody running a mimeograph and Xerox machine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to produce the kind of reports that you now would get online in this kind of information sharing situation. The truth is that companies' books are now more open and accessible than they have ever been. That's because filings with the SEC are now available online. It's easier to do research about individual companies, but that also means that they're more accountable for their practices and people are looking more closely. One of the, well, I guess you would call it a negative for the people involved, but one of the negatives of the increases in technology in organizations have been the dramatic decreases in what previously were called middle-level management. These are the people who essentially manage other managers. They're not the folks right down on the line supervising line employees, but instead they are the folks in the middle between the executive suite and the production line, so to speak. These folks really have been decimated by increases in technology because now workers can be monitored through technology, and you don't need to have people, watching the people who are watching the people, essentially. Middle-level management has really gotten crushed by technology because, again, we have the ability to supervise more people using fewer folks. A final change in organizations, and one that really can impact the way communication works in an organization, is the increased use of contract workers. Now, let me begin with a specific case and then kind of broaden it a little bit. If you are putting in a brand new IT system in your company, it may well beyond the education and the training of the individual IT folks that you have working for your company. And so in almost every case, what you would do is go outside and you would bring in people, contract workers, who would come in and do this very specialized, very time-consuming product. But then when their job was done, when the new product was installed, they would go away. These people were never employees of the company. They were on contract. For those of you in accounting or finance, you know the difference between an employee and a 1099. That's a reference to the IRS slip that their wages are reported on. And for these 1099 employees, the people who are working under contract, they have different working conditions and different kinds of standards that an employer has to meet in dealing with these folks. They don't have to be given vacation. They don't have to be given benefits. And in fact, because it's also important to note that the employers don't pay Social Security wages for these folks. They are expected, because they're reported out on a 1099, that they end up paying these themselves. In fact, as you guys all go out and look for jobs, you might be very careful to make sure that the job that you think you're getting and the fact that you think you're going to become an employee of a particular company, you may in fact become a contract worker who is not an official employee of a company at all. And if you're paid as a contract worker on a 1099, you've got to be aware of the fact that you're going to be held up for some fairly serious dough when April 15th comes around, because there's a self-employment tax, you've got to be responsible for your own Social Security, and you may find out you're making a lot less when it all nets out than if you had been an employee of a company. So be very careful about that. But I mention this within the scope of how technology impacts communication, because you can have situations at large companies, Microsoft, for instance. There have been books written on this particular issue that indicate that there was a true gulf between the people who were temporary, between the people who were contract workers and the people who were permanent, the people who were W-2 workers, that they were perhaps the folks who were temporary were unwilling to share a lot of information with the permanent employees because in their situation, information is power. The reason that they continue to be hired, the reason their contract is picked up again, is because they provide something useful to the organization. If the information that they know or if the information that they have that allows them to do their job were to be held by permanent employees, you could bet that a smart organization would get rid of those temporary employees because, frankly, they're not needed anymore. There can be rather sizable gulfs that are created in large organizations or even small ones between the people who are temporary and the people who are permanent. A lot of that has come about because we hire people now, because technology changes so rapidly, we bring in temporary workers to do a job that our own workers are perhaps not trained or were never trained to do. And so, again, even with when contract workers we're talking about, it can affect the patterns of communication within a company because they're far less willing to share information with the people who are there permanently. One of the things I hope to do is to give you a little bit of a perspective on how technology changes culture. And one of the people I want to turn to he's passed away now, but was a very big figure in the last half of the 20th century in educational theory and in an area that came to be called media ecology. But his name was Neil Postman. He was a professor at New York University and wrote a large number of books over the course of his career. But one of the books that was published in about the mid-1970s, I think, is appropriate for us to talk about here. It was called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And really was an indictment of the way in which television changes culture and changes things that we had not even expected to be thinking about when we're talking. I mean, of course, television changes educational patterns. And of course, television changes the number of hours that kids what they do in their leisure time. Fewer kids are outside playing because they're inside, watching television, or later in the century, they were inside playing video games or whatever else. But Postman was a very, very thoughtful guy. And he came out with, in his analysis of television, I mean, this was not just some slam on TV because it wasn't a fine art. It was not a slam on TV just because, well, if lots and lots of people consume it, it must not be very good. His was a more thoughtful critique, and he came up with a thesis that was more generalized to technology than it was specifically to television. And what he said was this: the dominant technology for an age has a profound effect on what passes for truth in a culture. So let me say that again. The dominant technology of the age has a profound effect on what passes for truth in a culture. Let me go back and maybe illustrate this thesis with some examples. I'm sure that a number of you have seen the Mad Max movies. And in one of the Mad Max movies, Mel Gibson as Mad Max ends up in this gathering of essentially children. These are all kids who've been orphaned by the nuclear apocalypse. And when Mad Max shows up at this little gathering, they kind of treat him as if he's a returning god, that he's come to save them in a sense. And the reason they treat him that way is they have this story culture, this storytelling culture in this post-apocalyptic child's village where tales are told about the return of an adult who will bring them to safety, about somebody who can solve the problems of their little gang, actually hundreds of kids in this movie. But it was the story that was key, because in prehistory, or if you take the Mad Max movie seriously, post-history, right? Once we've had apocalyptic nuclear attacks, culture is not doing great, but the point is that the culture is the same. There's no reading and there's no writing. There's simply storytelling. That's how it started out before we had people writing things down. The people in ancient Greece who held some of the most power, the people in prehistory who had the most power, were the storytellers, the oracles, the people who wrote, who transmitted the great epic poems of the time. Writing things down was the exception rather than the rule, and it was far more likely that people would simply, it was an oral culture. They would listen to the stories of the deeds of their ancestors, the story of Odysseus. All of these kind of tales would be handed down through these storytellers. What the dominant technology for the age was simply oral. It was one person telling another person a story. It's not until much later, as we get up into the, say, mid-1500s and 1600s, that culture begins to change dramatically because of the introduction of the printing press. What had been a very specialized kind of technology only known to a few people, right, that's writing, now because has the possibility for mass production. Because when you have a printing press, you don't have to copy by hand the Bible. You have the possibility that the Bible can be run off on this printing press, and instead of being held by just a few people in the town, it can be held by everybody in town because the printing technology makes this possible. There's also a profound effect if you think about the changeover from an oral culture to a written culture in the way judicial services are rendered. Remember, what changes here is that it used to be an oral contract was solid, but now we move to a situation in the last half of, certainly in the 20th century, where the oral culture is replaced by the written culture, and at least in the judicial realm, if a contract is not written down, a contract is far less to be upheld as valid. You have to have it in writing. What used to be the way that you got a doctoral degree was simply an oral defense of a thesis that you put together and thought about and worked hard on, now becomes a document. It becomes the doctoral dissertation as the basis, the true basis for conferring a PhD on somebody. So technology is changing radically what passes for knowledge in our culture. Knowledge used to be whatever the storyteller said. Now knowledge has become whatever is written down. If it's in a book, must be knowledge, right? Somebody had to pass on whether or not this was appropriate, whether or not it was true. Now, what Postman argues is with the advent of technology, and I would extend the advent of computers in the workplace and at home, once again, we see a change from merely what's written down to a more visual culture where we're talking about what we see. Seeing is believing. It becomes kind of the part and parcel of this. And now, with the aid of computers, we know that somebody simply thinking good thoughts and writing a journal may not be believed as much as somebody who can put together a series of charts and graphs and has the statistics to back up what their claim is. In that case, it's even if somebody smart writes a book, somebody who has data, somebody who has statistics, and somebody who has the ability to represent and present those statistics in public in a powerful and persuasive way is likely to win that contest. So Postman argues that in a sense, it's not the technology, it's not the television is evil. It's just that when technology tries to do things that it didn't used to do before, he argues, for instance, that, you know, television is perfectly fine when all television tries to do is to entertain people. But when it tries to do other things like educate people or be their church or be their voting booth, we have a far more serious condition because now we've got television doing things we never did before. If we want to apply this into a business setting, I think the point is that increasingly information technologies, those things that allow us to make great business presentations, sorry, had a little frog in my throat there, but increasingly technology allows us or will color our judgments about the credibility of information that's being produced by people. In the past, a business presentation was fine if it was accompanied by a few black and white handouts. Now, increasingly, you see the expectations being raised that people have the associated visual aids that appropriately go with a presentation, that that presentation be available to you on a DVD now. Again, technology is stepping up and changing what passes for knowledge. If you had a good philosophy course, in the recent past, you probably stumbled across a word called epistemology. Epistemology is the study of knowledge and the study of how cultures confer the label of knowledge on some information, but not others. Why, for instance, is it knowledge when it comes out in a government report, but when somebody reads the entrails of chickens, it's not knowledge. It's just, a suspicion and myth. Those kinds of labels are very powerful in a society. The people who get to be the ones to confer the label of knowledge, to confer institutional credibility, very importantly, those are the people who really help to control society. And so I would argue that technology is altering the way in which we confer that label of knowledge, the way in which we confer credibility on certain kinds of materials, and that results in big changes in communication. So I'm just trying to give you a sense that there has been some deep thinking that's gone on both in other fields, but also in my field of communication studies. And I think that there's fertile ground here for thinking about the way in which, as we move forward with technology, how ultimately is it going to affect communication. I mentioned earlier that certainly one of the biggest changes in the way in which people communicate in business has to do primarily with email. The figures in this area are unreliable. I have some that I think are probably out of date at this point, but the figures that I found is that in 2003, approximately 1.5 trillion email messages were being produced every year, and that they projected by 2007 that would nearly double to 2.7 trillion messages. I don't have a great statistic here, but I can tell you what we're looking at is it's everywhere. It's a lot, and everybody's getting deluged by email messages. Perhaps more importantly, though, is the statistic that's on the third bullet of your PowerPoint slide there, which suggests that 78% of U.S. businesses randomly check employee email. They're looking for people misusing email. They're looking for people receiving inappropriate messages over email or sending inappropriate messages over email. And you have to understand that if you're working for a private business, you're going to be on some certain level of surveillance. And interestingly, they don't even have to tell you that they're doing that. There was a law that was passed a few years ago to require employers to notify their employees when they were monitoring or the fact that they did monitor their email. That law was vetoed and ultimately never goes into law, so they don't even have to tell you that they're checking your email. In fact, and again, this figure is probably a few years out of date, but gives you an idea of the magnitude. A few years ago, there was a statistic that indicated not just that employers were randomly checking the email that people sent or received, but that for 14 million employees, they were under constant surveillance in their computer use. So not just email, but also their use of the web and web technologies. So if you were running a little small business from your regular day job, they were going to find out because they constantly monitor these things. If you were sending inappropriate messages, pornography or whatever else over the company's server, you were going to be found out. You are going to be found out. And I know that some of you are saying, well, how can they do that? This is a violation of my privacy. Well, funny you should ask that. I really will be talking about that in just a few minutes. The other thing that email has wrought, because it's now the archive of the daily business of what goes on inside companies, is that when businesses are engaged in lawsuits or litigation against one another, one of the first things that happens, one of the first things that proceeds in a lawsuit is called the discovery procedure. And what they do is they request the entirety of another company's email. When Microsoft was first smacked around under antitrust litigation, one of the best pieces of evidence that the people who prosecuted that case had against Bill Gates was Bill Gates's own words in Bill Gates's emails. He has kind of been hung, you know, hoisted on his own petard, in a sense. I have some examples here of some emails that formed the basis for litigation. It was reported in Wired magazine a few years ago. For instance, imagine if you were searching through another company's email for the smoking gun, as it were, that you came across this email. Yes, I know, we shipped 100 barrels of, and it turned out it was some horrible toxic waste. But on our end, steps have been taken to ensure that no record exists. Therefore, it doesn't exist, if you know what I mean. Remember, you owe me a golf game the next time I'm in town. Oh, my God. I mean, this is clear evidence of an illegal act, the shipping of this toxic waste, the destruction of the records about that toxic waste, and then you've got this email indicating there was agreement on both sides that this was going to happen. What more powerful evidence would a prosecutor need in order to go after this company for illegal shipping of toxic waste? On the next slide, you see one that was part of a malpractice lawsuit where one of the surgical nurses was writing to a friend, "Did you see what Dr. X did today? If that patient survives, it will be a miracle." Oh, great. This is what you want when you're trying to defend the doctor, when they're able to come up with somebody who was in attendance at the surgical procedure is writing to a friend saying that the doctor completely screwed up. And then there's this little gem that was also pulled out of a record of a lawsuit. "Hi, David. Please destroy the evidence on the," it was litigation, "you and I talked about today. Thanks, Laura." The response, "Hi, Laura, acknowledge your message and taken care of. Aloha, David." Well, David and Laura, by virtue of these two little emails, are not only engaged in destruction of evidence, obstruction of justice, they're also engaged in a conspiracy, and it's all right here for the prosecutor to take before a jury because it's been preserved in email. Now, I know there's those of you out there who think, oh, well, you know, no big deal. I delete email as it comes in. If it's a particularly nasty piece of email, well, I just delete it. Well, you understand, don't you, I hope, that you've taken enough basic computer courses to understand that when you delete an email, at least on your basic PC, you're not actually scrubbing it from the hard drive. What you're doing is you're erasing the path that would make that email easily found. That's what gets deleted. But the point is that there is technology today that allows us to recover those emails from that hard drive, and there are companies that do nothing but support lawyers and support law firms by being the ones who comb through. I mean, if you are to subpoena the email of a company for a period of 3 months, there may be hundreds of millions of emails there. These people are not printing them out and reading them one by one. They use a filtering system or an algorithm to go through all these emails by computer and pull out certain key words or to flag certain emails to look at because they talk about things in a particular way. These couple of instances from Wired magazine suggest that, you know, as you always have heard, if you don't want something on the front page of the New York Times, then please don't put it in an email. And that's never been more true than at the end of the dot-com bust, where a number of brokers, a number of people who rated internet stocks, saw their emails literally on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So that while they were telling clients that these stocks were safe, that they were substantive, that they were a good investment, they were telling their friends or the people internally at the brokerage that these things were dogs, that they were going to lose money, and that they should dump them as fast as they can. There are a number of those people who were caught with their emails down, essentially, and have been barred from ever participating in that kind of industry ever. So you can see that the use of emails is fraught with some dangers. Let me talk about a little bit about this privacy issue that I raised a few minutes ago. Have you ever noticed that federal legislation is often almost exactly the opposite of what it's named? And in this case, we have a great example of it. For instance, in 1986, a law was passed called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And really what it said is that employees of a company have absolutely no expectation of privacy. The computer that you have on your desk is actually owned by the company. The hard drive is owned by the company. The email system is owned by the company. And as a result, they have an absolute right to monitor your messages, to filter your email, to check it whenever they want to see if you're doing something that's not associated with your job or to see if you're doing something that's illegal. And so ultimately, because we know that email is retrievable even after it's deleted on your desktop, and because the companies have a complete right to scan your email whenever they feel like it, it's true that you have no expectation of privacy. Now, is that also true here at school? Well, that's a little bit fuzzier, and let me explain. Because you're at a university, because the state owns it, they have stricter constitutional guidelines that they have to play by. And I can tell you that the people who run the information technology systems at the university are very careful about issues related to privacy. But still and again, I would not think that you would be able to sustain a claim of violation of privacy rights if the university, for instance, finds you massively downloading illegally copied content. You know, let's say you're downloading movies or music over the internet that's copyrighted. You don't have a privacy right that you can claim, oh, they should never have found this information because that's my email account. Well, the truth is, it's your email account that the university lets you use. So you have to be very careful about that. One other thing, if you are working for a company and you use your private email, like let's say you have a Hotmail account or a Gmail account or a Yahoo account, if you communicate with your workplace in any way, like you decide you're working on a file for work at home and you send it into the company via your email, private email organizations, private email carriers, ISPs, Internet Service Providers, there we go, they fold like a cheap lawn chair when presented with a subpoena. And if you have used your private email to communicate with work, they can seize the records from your Internet Service Provider of all the emails that you've sent communicating with work and even the ones you haven't. And so you open yourself up to the same kind of scrutiny, even though you have a private account. Remember that AOL and Hotmail and Gmail get hundreds of subpoenas every year. And in each case, what they do is they pretty much automatically turn over the material that's requested. And whether it's by law enforcement personnel or whether it's by attorneys in civil litigation, these ISPs don't have the resources or the inclination to fight for your privacy rights. And the result is that information almost certainly will be discovered. So email perhaps is not what you might think it is. It appears to be something that you have control over. It appears that, you know, it's something that you can use at the office and not be too concerned about. But I think the reverse is in fact true. I want to move on to, actually, this is something that's just come out, and I wanted to be sure and include it in the lecture. There's a brand new book that's now available by David Shipley, that's S-H-I-P-L-E-Y, and Will Schwalbe, S-C-H-W-A-L-B-E, and it's called Send, The Essential Guide to Email for Office and Home. And it's printed, it's been published by Knopf Publishers, that's K-N-O-P-F. It's an awfully good-looking book. I have only read a very good review of it. I have not read the entire book yet because literally it came out just a few days ago. But let me quote the authors on why email is so difficult for us to get control of. They say, on email, people aren't quite themselves. They are angrier, less sympathetic, less aware, more easily wounded, even more gossipy and duplicitous. Email has a tendency to encourage the lesser angels of our nature. I think that's very nicely put. The point is that we tend to say things on email that we would not normally commit to print. We're less guarded in the way we communicate with people, and yet this is a technology that is more open to searching, that ultimately preserves our words far longer than almost any other form of communication. You could say something nasty to somebody in the hallway to a friend and be pretty certain that unless somebody was listening in, that it would simply be between the two of you. If you send that same remark over email to a friend in the company, that email, even after you delete it, even if you completely reformatted the hard drive on your PC, is likely to be archived in the servers of that company and available for discovery at a later time. So we act as if email is ephemeral, that it's transient, that it disappears after we use it, when in fact it's exactly the opposite. It's permanent, it stays where it is, and it's searchable by people who might seek to do us harm. Among the other things that Shipley and Schwab talk about that I thought kind of interesting is they note that email has made a special kind of apology necessary. If, for instance, you inappropriately say something over email about somebody, they say the worst thing you can do, the absolute worst thing you can do, would be to apologize via email. They make a very good argument that this, in fact, trivializes the original offense, and that what's very, very important, if at all possible, is that if you're going to apologize for something that you said over email, do it in person. Don't do it on email, because ultimately the apology won't be taken as well. A second thing that Shipley and his co-author say in this book that I think is very important to remember is that there is no tone in email. Remember we talked about vocalics when we talked about nonverbal communication and how the tone of somebody's voice is very important in portraying exactly what you really mean. So if my wife asks me if I like her new hairdo and I say, oh yeah, it's beautiful. I can't imagine a better looking hairdo. Not only am I going to get smacked, but she's going to get the true meaning of my message because of the tone of my voice. Well, in email, you have kind of the opposite problem where there is no tone. We may think we're joking. We may think we're being serious. We may say, oh, I was just being kind of cynical, or I was just being playful. But none of that gets communicated effectively over email. And as a result, listen to what Shipley says. If you don't consciously insert tone in an email, a kind of universal default tone won't automatically be conveyed. Instead, the message written without regard to tone becomes a blank screen onto which the reader projects his own fears, prejudices, and anxieties. Beautifully put, and makes me want to go out and buy this book. Because if you don't pay attention to what you're saying in these emails and the way that you're saying it, whatever message you think you may be trying to convey, it's unlikely to be conveyed effectively because it is so difficult to convey tone. A third and final thing I just wanted to mention from this book, again, it's called Send, and the subtitle is The Essential Guide to Email for Office and Home. And believe me, if I had found this early in the semester, it might well have been a required text. The other thing I want to suggest is I want you to avoid quick, intemperate responses. It always feels good to dash off a response in an email saying something clever or biting or catty, and you revel in thinking about how great you are as a writer, and boy, that showed him, and boy, what a tough guy I am, or, I really smacked her around, whatever. It's almost always the inappropriate response. Because email is so immediate, because it's so easy to just hit that reply button and slam whoever just sent you an email, it's far easier for people to get drawn into these kind of exchanges. I think the key term you want to remember, or the phrase to remember, is that you almost always want to avoid the emotionally satisfying response to someone. Because it'll almost always, I think, get you in trouble. The point is that because it's so easy to kind of slam off a reply, you're going to say something you probably shouldn't have said. It may make you feel good right at that moment, but in the long run, it's probably not going to be terribly productive because it will simply provoke the other person to whom you're responding. Final thing in this lecture I want to mention, and yes, this is a little bit shorter than previous lectures, is the importance of what's now called a knowledge management program in businesses. This is particularly important if you're working for a large company, but a knowledge management program, among other things, will think seriously about the way email is archived at a particular location. And it will take seriously questions like, how long should this company save emails? Should they, and there are some companies, for instance, that purge their files every 3 months or every 6 months so that there's no longer an institutional backup for these kinds of things. And it's not particularly because storage is expensive, though it can be, but the truth is that there may be material in those emails that they feel will get them in trouble. They've been subject to litigation in the past, and they feel like scrubbing the server every 3 months or 6 months is a good thing to do. But you have to remember that that company needs to be responsive to the needs of outside regulatory agencies. So, for instance, if you're engaged in the sale of securities at all, there are regulations by the Securities and Exchange Commission that say that you have to keep certain things like emails for a length of time, sometimes 5 or even 7 years. If you're in a public business that gets audited, it may be that it's illegal for you actually to get rid of certain emails. Even in government practice, you know that we've had these controversies about emails that have been generated out of the White House. Well, if they're actually government business coming out of the White House, they are easily discoverable by subpoena, and that's what the Congress is trying to get. But the White House, I think, paying attention to the fact that people ought not be doing partisan political politics on the government's tab, established a separate communication network of laptop computers for when they were doing, say, business with the Republican National Committee. And those emails are arguably subject to a more protection, and those people have more privacy rights on those kind of emails. But the problem, of course, is that they didn't always keep them separate. And some of those emails on the private system were actually about government business, and some of the emails on the government system were actually about the private business related to the partisan business that carried on in the Republican National Party. And that's why they've got the mess they've got right now, and you've got people kind of trying to fight subpoenas, and you've got people trying to deliver subpoenas to get information to investigate whatever cause it is they're investigating. The point is that when you go into a company, it's important as a part of your orientation sessions or as a part of a question that you ask at some point, does this company have a knowledge management program? It would talk about what kind of surveillance there is for employees. It would talk about what kind of privacy rights, if any, employees have. It talks about where and when data can be backed up and for how long it must be kept. Smart companies have come to realize that a knowledge management program, particularly for their email systems, is an extremely important part of securing information about making them less vulnerable to lawsuits, and they need to think very seriously about this kind of stuff. So I'm going to end this lecture simply noting that technology, I think, has had a profound effect on the way in which we communicate at work. It changes the way organizations are structured. It changes because of the vast and easy access that we have to email, and that as members of these organizations, we have to pay attention not only to our individual goals when we use email systems, but to understand that we may be doing something that puts our employer at risk, and employers who have good knowledge management programs, and they train their employees on those knowledge management programs so that they know what to keep and what's likely to be scrubbed or whatever else, that's perhaps the best situation for everybody. Okay, that'll do it for today. Thanks very much.